Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on the part of the world that you're calling in from. My name is Amit Dungrani, and I'm really excited to be your host for this week's Global Awaken Call. Now, every story is the beginning of a conversation, and whether it's with ourselves or with others, across time and culture, stories have been the agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls are to share stories from the lives of incredible change makers from around the world. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Today, we have a really special guest speaker with us, Pranidhi Vashni, whose efforts to align her head, her heart, and hands, often literally as a yoga practitioner, embodies the spirit of our calls. Pranidhi is a devoted Ashtanga yoga practitioner and teacher. She founded Yogashala West, a community-supported Ashtanga yoga studio in West LA. She teaches to share the deep love that she has for yoga practice and for all students who follow this path. In addition to managing and teaching at the Shala, Pranidhi produces open source practice videos to support greater access to yoga and holds space for deeper experiments and leading with values. She writes regularly. She has released a stirring album of Sanskrit chanting, which if you've ever get a chance to hear her voice, I definitely will tell you, you will be moved by it. She serves as a Yoga Gives Back ambassador, sits on the advisory board of the Yoga and Body Image Coalition, and volunteers with Service Spaces Laddership Circles, including being a mentor for the Service Space internship last year, really impacting the lives of some of the young folks that we had participate. What makes Pranidhi's journey even more interesting is that she was a theater and psychology student at Northwestern, who originally pursued a career in acting. However, at some point during that journey, something changed in her and moved her life into a different direction. So we're looking forward to hearing both about her personal journey and this shift within her that led her to where she is today and on the call with us. We're very grateful to have her with us today. And staying on that note of gratitude, behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We're thankful to them and to all of our listeners for co-creating today's call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves and truly bring our full attention and presence to the call. So a minute of silence, please. Thank you. So again, welcome to our weekly Awaken call. Here's how today's call will work. In a few minutes, I'm going to turn things over to our moderator, Angela, who will briefly share some thoughts with us and then provide a more formal introduction of Pranidhi. And then the two of them will engage in a deep dialogue until about the top of the hour, and then we'll roll into a Q&A and circular sharing. And this is really the part of the call where we invite all of you to share your reflections and questions. And so we hope that you participate. I've actually gone ahead and opened up the Q&A right now so that at any point during the call, you can enter the queue to eventually ask your question. All you have to do is hit *6 on your phone, and then when we do the Q&A, you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. And for those of you that are listening via our live stream or just feeling shy, you can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. So our theme or title for this week's call has been Staying Strong in Values. We have the great pleasure of having Angela as our moderator today. And, you know, she's a spiritualist in her own right, and she also happens to be a student of Pranidhi's, which makes us sort of an extra special perspective in approaching the call. Pranidhi has established this thriving LA yoga studio even as she emphasized growth of values rather than growth of numbers and income. Not caving to contemporary image-driven yoga culture, she's remained true to deeper healing qualities of the practice. And so we're asking our callers, how have you remained strong in your values against the cross currents of societal practices and pressures? And so, Angela, I thought maybe you could kick off the circle, maybe share some of your own experiences or those of people around you of how you've remained strong in your values against the cross currents of societal practices and pressures. And then feel free to just lead us right into your conversation with Pranithi.
Thank you so much, and I'm so grateful to be here. I'm utterly honored to have this opportunity to moderate this call. If through the sharings I have, the questions I bring to Pranithi, if we're provided even a glimpse into her consciousness this morning, we are all so deeply blessed. So I'm so grateful to be here. And, you know, I love this question, how am I staying strong in my values? And I have to say one of the confrontive things about that question is I'm really called to question what are my values. And as I've moved through my life, you know, my values have deepened, my values have changed. So I'm so aware that that question, it's such a living question. It's not like, well, you know, in 1997, I figured out what my values are. And, you know, I've been, you know, at it ever since. You know, we change and grow every day. So, you know, I'm almost scared of that question when I hear it, like, have I thought about my values? Am I living my values? And for me, as a spiritual practitioner of 23 years, seeing clients on a daily basis, you know, one after another for all these years, you know, what I value so deeply is prayer. And I believe in prayer in a way that transcends religious doctrine. I believe it's one of our deepest human instincts, in fact, like breathing or sleeping. And it's reaching beyond whatever sense of limitation I'm having in this moment, whether it's the limitation of my greed, my fear, my, fatigue, and to dig deep into whatever for each of us a sense of higher power is. Whether we're atheist, we might think of that as our subconscious mind, varying, you know, whatever our varying backgrounds are. So how I stay true to my values is I practice prayer, and my practice evolves, and I do my best to bring that to the world. And that's how I stay true to myself to the best of my ability, you know, even as I make, you know, 899 mistakes a day. So I appreciate that question, and I do believe Pranithi is both a prayer, her life is a prayer, and her life is an answered prayer. So I'm, you know, fascinated by how Pranithi has created what she has created in her life. And I just want to say how I have met Pranithi personally, and then speak a little bit more about her work, and then we'll dive deep into our questions for her this day. So I live in Los Angeles, and Pranithi lives in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is an area of more than 14 million people, and it's a conglomeration of 80 different areas. You know, they're named Beverly Hills, Culver City, and I live in a little one named Westchester. And we refer to my area as, or those of us who live here refer to it as the Mayberry of L.A. It's just a sweet little community, and we have a community Y, formerly known as the YMCA. The name now is just the Y, and it is a community center where there are many classes for exercise classes and equipment for exercise. And Pranithi taught a yoga class there, and I was always so interested in coming to that class, but it didn't quite work out the time it was when I had to get my daughter to school in the morning. And I definitely thought of it as a more advanced yoga class than what I would be able to do. But one day I got myself there, and oh my God, I wept. I actually wept that first day. I couldn't believe. I felt like I had gone through a portal into another reality in that moment. And Prunity sings to us at the end of class, and we chant with her at the beginning. And that's when I was introduced to the Ashtanga yoga practice that Prunity practices, she's a master teacher of, and now she's the founder of Yogashala West, which is her own value-based center. And so there's something about the humble beginnings of this Y yoga class, and she taught other places in LA too. I think you must have been in your car going from class to class then. And it built from a deep place of community, I believe. So again, as you so beautifully said, Amit, in the opening introduction that you did, you know, Prunity is an extraordinary, inspiring yoga practitioner of the Ashtanga tradition. She has founded a jewel in the heart of the west side of Los Angeles that is truly counter the cultural norm for how yoga is experienced in West Los Angeles. And she is an artist with her extraordinary voice. She's an activist with her Yoga Gives Back work. And she's also a provocateur. She, in Prunity's writing, I mean, just some of the titles of the things you can find online: Coming Out as a Conscious Omnivore, The Business of Teaching Yoga, The Quote-Unquote Ideal Yoga Diet, Confessions of an Indian American Yogi. I mean, there is a wealth of gifts that she brings to us. The first question I want to bring to you, Prunity, and thank you so much for being here and offering your heart and your wisdom to all of us. I want to know, how do you feel as you hear Amit and I talk about you? Like, how does it feel when you hear all of this?
That's a great question.
So funny because I was like, man, I wonder if I could just sit here quietly for 90 minutes and have people say nice things about me. It's really such an honor. And, you know, I have such a smile on my face as I hear you both talk, and sort of a warm feeling in my belly and just so much gratitude. Because though you're saying all these nice things about me, I hear them with this understanding that the manifestations of my work, it's all possible because of the community that surrounds me, and the service-based community has been a huge part of my ability to grow in my values and really keep that at the core of what I'm doing. So I just feel very grateful and honored to be here. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if it's almost a little bit of an out-of-body experience, because my sense is you are putting one foot in front of the other and you're doing the work, and just to feel the breadth and depth of what has already been accomplished really is a testimony to practice itself, practicing that of your values and that of your yes. yoga.
Yes. And I wanted to point out one thing that you had said earlier, which I loved, Angela, when you were speaking about your own work, is that, you know, the 899 mistakes. I just love that, because I think for people who are on any sort of path of practice, whether it's a spiritual practice or any type of practice in which we're trying to become conscious and bring ourselves into the present moment and connect with other beings, there can be this sense that, well, we must really have to have it all together all the time, you know? And I just so appreciated the vulnerability and just the realness of what you said, is that we do make mistakes, a lot of them, you know?
Yes.
And then we take the next step.
Right. And I think it's true to who you are that you would bring that up at the beginning of the call. You know, right now in our culture, there's a lot of conversation about othering. You know, we're trying to solve this tendency within human consciousness to other someone that we might not express our compassion because they're other. We also other inspiring people. You know, I'm not like them. I could never do it. I'm too flawed. And it really breaks down that barrier when you speak about the mistakes that you make as you move forward. And it's, I think it's so important for all of us to remember that that's part of the process. And as the call continues, I'm going to ask you about your biggest mistakes. But too, 'cause we want to know. Everyone wants to know the dirt. No, I'm teasing. I really want to begin with setting a context. I want to understand more fully your roots. I want to begin with your roots. Like, you know, even though you're my teacher and I'm with you many days of the week, I really don't know how you grew up. Of course, I know you're Indian American, but can you set the stage for us in terms of your cultural and environmental beginnings?
Sure. And my mom and dad might be on the call, so hi, Mama and Papa, just in case they're on the call. So I was born in India, in New Delhi, and I moved to the States around 6 years of age. And I was fortunate to have a strong Indian cultural upbringing with a context for our traditions. I grew up in a semi-religious household, but it was never really forced on us so strongly. But the awareness was there, you know, of our cultural traditions. And when I think of Indian culture, you know, food is like one of the first things that I think of. Because my mom was just always cooking for us. And so our culture was vibrant in our upbringing. And part of that was that on the weekends we would go to sort of a spiritual school, like it was called Chinmaya Mission. And that was really my first introduction to chanting. And it was interesting. At that time, the way it was taught to me, it was very much about the ritual and about memorization, and it lacked soul. I guess that's the best way that I could describe it. In my understanding of it at that time was that it lacked soul. I wasn't connecting to it on a deep level. But it was present. And so somehow I think it imprinted in a part of my brain, you know, the parts of our brains that develop at that young of an age.
Right.
But as I was continuing to grow, I sort of left that religious world for some time until I started practicing yoga. And it's funny, my first introduction to the asana practice, you know, the physical practice of yoga, was through a videotape that was called like Fat Burning Yoga or something, you know. And
practice yoga with your family as part of the Indian tradition?
No, not at all. And actually, it's funny, you know, the last time I was in India was about 6 years ago, and I was hanging out with local people around my age, and they used to make fun of me because I was there to practice yoga, and they would just make fun of me because yoga is so not in fashion in India, you know. It's not, it's like people like to go to the gym, and practicing yoga is sort of like a, I don't know, it's funny that my first introduction to the asana practice was this video called Fat Burning Yoga. But I remember practicing with my sister in the living room, you know, and then as I
So you were
college,
interested in burning fat.
I just had no, you know, we would do like, it was just part of our rotation. So my sister and I would do Tai Bo one day, and then one day we would do fat burning yoga. It's just so funny, you know, that was my first introduction to the asana practice. But I was really fortunate that when I went to college, which was in 2002, I went to college at Northwestern in Chicago, outside of Chicago. And during that time, I found this yoga class that met once a week at my local gym. And that, too, was called power yoga, something like that, power yoga. And I really loved the class. And I didn't know much about yoga at that time, but I loved the class. I started researching a little bit more, trying to find out what is this yoga that we're doing. And I realized that what we were actually practicing was the primary series of Ashtanga yoga.
Wow.
And, yeah, so that was actually, you know, the first real yoga that I did was actually Ashtanga, even though I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know that's what it was called. So that was the first little seed that was planted, and then I slowly started taking Ashtanga classes at another studio, and then once I moved to L.A., actually before I moved to L.A., shortly before I moved to L.A., I committed to a daily practice, and then that's when it all really started to change. And I've gotten quite off track from the question that you were doing.
No, this is important. This is important because this lays the context. So I'm very fascinated that you're coming to yoga even as you were steeped in your roots, in your culture. Your yoga, it sounds like, came more from just being in America and trying different ways
yes.
of working out.
Yeah, that's totally true. And, you know, that's why I don't, you know, people often ask me, like, what do you think of all this? There's so much, you know, yoga out there. Like, is it real? Is it authentic? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I try to remember this story that was told to me by a senior teacher in our lineage. She was asking her teacher, Pattabhi Joyce, who is the guru of our lineage, she was asking him, you know, there's so many different types of yoga out there. People are just doing whatever they want, calling it yoga. Like, Guruji, what do you think about all this, you know? And he said, Nancy, just to hear the word yoga in a lifetime is a blessing.
Yes.
And that has stuck with me because it just allowed me to view the whole yoga landscape from a place of non-judgment. And just remember that my introduction was a videotape called Fat Burning Yoga. So if someone's introduction is yoga on a stand-up paddleboard or, you know, like yoga and wine, I mean, though I may have opinions on those things, I try not to judge because it's just a seed, you know, and it could flourish in so many ways, just like it did for me.
So I'm so interested in, as you practice yoga, as you go from fat-burning yoga to power yoga, to wanting to know more about what it is you're doing, to understanding, oh, that's the primary series, and then you deepen and study with master yogis of this tradition. What did it mean to you in terms of being Indian?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it reminds me, actually, of what I was saying about the chanting. You know, how I had mentioned that early on, I grew up chanting, but didn't feel that soul-level resonance with it. And it was only through diving deeper into my yoga practice that I actually rediscovered the roots of the chanting, you know, the felt experience of chanting, what it felt like in my body, what it felt like to chant with other beings in a way that transcended language, or our, you know, like you mentioned, our tendency to other. When we chant at the beginning of Mysore practice, this is the traditional method of Ashtanga yoga. It's called Mysore style practice. And when the teacher walks into the room, she stands up in the front of the room and all the students then chant together. And in that moment, we transcend our differences. It doesn't matter whether we can speak English or Korean, or Spanish, or whatever. Every practitioner of Ashtanga yoga knows that mantra. And so, yeah, it's just such a beautiful moment in which we all connect on the soul level. And so through the Ashtanga yoga practice, I began to connect to chanting on that soul level. And my Indianness, it's interesting you bring that up, because I felt this sense of coming home when I discovered this practice, because it just felt natural in my body. It felt natural in my voice. And it just felt like coming home.
It's so beautiful. And, you know, the value to me of the sharing as I listen in where I feel it offers so much hope for all of us listening is what I'm hearing is that you followed your curiosity and you followed what felt really good to you. Mm. And in that process, you felt a coming, this, as you say, a coming home to yourself. And I find this so powerful that can be trusted. You know, so for many of us, we're afraid to follow something like that because, you know, we've got to put food on the table. We've got to, mm-hmm. you know, we've got to do something that is marketable today. You know, so yeah. I think it's so interesting, you know, to value as we're, you know, going to be focusing in this call more and more on staying true to our values, staying strong in our values. What an amazing thing it is to consider that this process of following our curiosity, following what feels good to us, and trusting the more we get clear about our values mm-hmm. and what mm-hmm. feels like home to us, that is us on our path of life.
Yes.
Now, I know for you at the same time that you were, you know, in college, you're studying psychology and music and theater, and I'm assuming you moved to L.A. For acting. Is that true?
Yes. Well, it was twofold. I was working as an actress in Chicago for a couple of years, and I got booked on a tour that went through Berkeley and Kansas City. And that tour, I think, was maybe 5 or 6 months total-ish. And I had decided that after that tour, I was going to move to L.A., partly because of, I wanted to explore the opportunities out here in terms of the arts industry, the acting industry. But also, I just needed a lifestyle change. I was living in Chicago and just getting quite depressed in the winters. Mm-hmm. And I joke that my body was just never meant to live in that type of climate. I mean, I joke about it, but I do think there's a kernel of truth there, you know, because once I moved here, things really did open up for me energetically. And it was interesting that
the impact of the sunlight on those in Southern California. Yeah. Yes. Continue.
Yeah. All I was going to add is that during that tour is actually, it's interesting, it was when I was on the road that I really decided to commit to a daily Ashtanga yoga practice. And before then, I had been practicing maybe 2 to 3 times a week. And then while I was on the road is when I realized, wow, I need the discipline of practicing daily because I don't have any other sense of stability. And so that was the beginning of my daily practice. Mm.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me about how you navigated this deepening, you were deepening in your realization that you value this practice. You know, mm-hmm. I need it 2 to 3 days a week. Now I need it every day or 6 days a week on the road. And as you do move to LA and you are experiencing the entertainment industry and navigating your way in the industry as an actress and continuing to pursue Ashtanga yoga. I don't know when exactly you began to teach, but can you speak about the inner transformation of that and the process
sure.
of that? Because there may be listeners who are, you know, having some kind of melding experience themselves, and it's so difficult at times not to compartmentalize our lives. Okay, you mm-hmm. know, I do the yoga to stay in shape, and I, you know, do this and do that. And mm-hmm. how did that mm-hmm. happen for you in the internal realms?
That's such a good question. And as you ask the question, what comes to mind for me is that it was all about the body. It was like I came to LA and It was interesting, you know, and I'm going to challenge myself to be more vulnerable. It's one of the challenges that I'm giving to myself these days in all aspects of my life is to be courageously vulnerable. And so I want to share that very soon after moving to LA, I had found an agent, and one of the first conversations I had with my agent was a conversation in which this agent told me I would need to lose weight if I wanted to make it here. And that wasn't the only conversation that I had like that. I also had a manager that gave me very similar feedback. And so that was really my introduction to the business here, you know. At that time, though, I felt strong enough in myself to just hear that and respond with a no, with a sort of, you know, like, well, I'm going to do me, and if you don't want to work with me because of that, then that's fine. And I was lucky that my agent sort of heard that and chose to work with me anyway. And but I think that experience was really indicative of what the industry is here, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very external approach to the body. It's like, how can we manipulate our bodies and really exacerbate our own insecurities and make ourselves fit into these certain molds, because that's what society values, right? It's leading with these image-based values rather than these values based on inner transformation. But I continued, regardless, to work in the industry for several years. And during that time, was doing a yoga teacher training, continuing to practice daily, and teaching a little bit here and there. And it was around that time at some point that I started to teach at the Y. And while I was teaching at the Y, I was working as an actress and teaching yoga. And what started to happen is I noticed this change in my body where when my agent would call me, I would get nervous in a way that wasn't an excited type of nervous. It was like a dread type of nervous. You know, it was like, oh, I have to go on an audition, you know, like that type of feeling in the body. And I started realizing, my body's not excited to go on these auditions. My body doesn't feel good about this work. And what I also started to sense was that I wasn't giving either thing my full presence. I wasn't giving acting my full presence, and I wasn't giving the yoga teaching my full presence. And so it just ended up being a very natural process that I started to think, okay, so what's really feeding me here? You know, what's nourishing me? And the answer just started to become yoga more and more and more. And once I really made the transition and I said, you know, I'm no longer investing in this other part of my life or this other career, then the yoga really started to flourish. That's, you know, I felt like what happened is I made an active choice, and that act of making it an empowered active choice is what allowed the yoga then to blossom even more, because I was choosing to give it my full presence and energy. And I didn't want to say that within that process, I think the hardest thing was that I had had this dream from such a young age. I had this dream that I was going to be in the arts, and the burial of that dream, that was the hard part. But it's just such a metaphor for life, because when we bury something, it allows for other things to grow.
Yes, yes, so true. You know, there's such rich value in your sharing, and so deeply am I grateful for your vulnerability and your sharing. And I think about that moment when you're in that agent's office and they're saying, well, you know, you need to lose weight. And something in you in that moment was able to choose self-love over self-image. Mm. And I think that that's such an important choice point that we have. You know, so many of us, we're just trying to get a life that looks like a good life, you know, that looks like the right life, that looks like the good work. And we're not in the felt sense of it, you know, because we're choosing self-image over self-love. And, you know.
And I think, you know, this is why Sorry, go ahead.
Please, Angela.
No, I just, what you're saying is just so resonant for me, because this is why I love the yoga practice, is that it allows me an opportunity to practice self-love each day when I get on the mat. And I think what I needed in that in those early years in LA, where I was feeling a lot of pressure to conform externally, I needed a practice that was giving me a felt sense of the body every day. And that's just why I love yoga, because it gives me a felt sense of the body. And so many of us walk around every day without that. We're just living from the neck up, you know?
So I'm just so
grateful for this practice, because it allows me to tap into that deeper wisdom of the body.
And I wonder, too, if it's true that which saves our life is the place from which we are to give service, because we're giving from an internal need, meaning I'm not looking out there. You didn't look out there and go, okay, what does LA need? LA needs more yoga. You know, I better get yoga. You know, you're not looking out there to look for the external need, and then you're filling it. And I believe that when we give looking out there for what we perceive to be the lack, I have a sense that's out of which where burnout comes from, you know? And when we're giving from within, this saved my life, and I need to give from what is saving my life, I wonder then if we tap into something that's inexhaustible. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't require rest and breaks, but the inspiration, you know, though of course inspiration comes and ebbs and flows, the inspiration is there. And I'm also wondering if you're also presenting us with a very important guidance about listen to your body. You know, I've heard so often people say the body doesn't lie, you know? You know, I felt, you know, when I met my husband, you know, he wasn't what I would have called my type. And even my girlfriend, one of my girlfriends said something about him that was like, oh, I don't know, I think of you as needing to be with someone more vital than him or something like that. and my head was just like, he didn't live in the right place, he didn't wear the right clothes, but my body, and I don't mean just sexual attraction, but my like the wisdom of my body just was like, I feel good with him. I feel like me with him. I feel safe with him. I feel happy with him. And I kept walking toward that, even though my mind was all this chatter. And it's funny, the same girlfriend, years later, we're having lunch, and I say something about, you know, life and my husband, Fran. She goes, well, we don't all have a Fran Montano. So, it's just something about following the wisdom of your body. But you do have to get still and listen, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. The practice, you know, that's supremely important. And, you know, one thing you mentioned was I found really interesting was that, you know, it wasn't like I was searching for, LA needs more yoga, let me give it more yoga, because LA does not need more yoga. There's yoga studios are like gas stations around here, or Starbucks, you know, there's like one on every corner. So in terms of rational, you know, sort of planning, like a yoga studio is not really, there's no need for it. But what I did feel, which you very astutely picked up on, was I felt like the method that had saved me, the form of practice, the way it was taught by me to my teacher, the love with which it was taught and the humor with which it was taught and shared with me, that was something that I could uniquely offer. And I felt really moved to offer that. And I think because of that uniqueness, our community has really thrived. And I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to be able to hold space in such a way and for this community to have arisen, of which you are an integral part.
Yes, and And that's such an important distinction, because as I had practiced yoga at various places, I never practiced yoga, my own practice. I was always just waiting for a teacher to tell me what to do next.
Right.
And it wasn't until you brought this into my life that I found my own rhythm, and it's made an extraordinary difference in my life. I want to go back to the burying of a dream. You know, I wonder if devotion to service is not really born until we've buried a dream, to give birth to that deeper devotion. And this idea of burying a dream also goes counter to culture, you know, especially here in the United States. Those of us in the United States, you know, it's like, make your dream come true, never get up, give up, you know, dream it, believe it, have it, you know, and when it's time to bury a dream, you know, what was the most important thing that you can speak to that gave you the capacity to actually let go of something? You had dreamed about it being a certain way for so long.
Yeah.
And this being this way would be what meant you were successful, what meant your life had meaning, it's what meant you made it. Like, how do you put that in the ground?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. And what's coming up for me is that it was just so supremely important to have a support system, because failure is a word, like, this is a concept that we are so scared of in our society. This failing is like the worst. It's the worst thing that can happen to us, you know? And so I think that's what I was afraid of. I was afraid of being perceived as a failure. And I think what allowed me to step into that fear is the support system, particularly of my husband, who has a completely different background than I do. He's an entrepreneur in the tech world, and in that world, you know, failure is sort of just a part of the game. Like, you try one thing, it doesn't work. Okay, you try another. You try this other thing, it doesn't work. Okay, you try another, and you keep trying and iterating until you find that one thing that really lands. And so that context helped me a lot, because I just didn't have that context before. I had the context you were speaking of, which is, you know, I have a dream, and if that dream doesn't thrive, then I have failed.
Yeah.
And so that just having a different context was incredibly helpful.
Beautiful. And that's a wonderful thing for us to all look at, is where are we willing to reframe what success is? You know, where are we willing to reframe what, you know, what is necessary for our moving forward? And I you know, in researching more about you as preparing for this call, you know, I looked at more of your videos, your open source yoga videos. And isn't it amazing? You're on screen. I mean, one of the videos I looked at has over 200,000 clicks. And that is people, you know, really experiencing the heart and soul of you in your authentic expression. And so I have a feeling that even in the burying of the dream, there's another way in which the dream was to come full circle and have a new iteration. But it's difficult to give up the old iteration, you know, the idea that that's it, you know. And thank goodness you're willing to get in front of a camera with your voice, with your mind, with your body, and present. And that is performance in a certain way. It's at least presentation, do you know?
Absolutely. And I'm so grateful for those experiences, because they did give me a set of skills that have allowed that have transferred to this other part of this other stage of my life and work. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I know that, you know, from this point of you determined to connect more deeply into, and I loved how you said, an empowered active choice, an empowered active choice. And as I was hearing you say that, when you really chose to go more full throttle with what was actually feeding you, and you connected to that by realizing, I feel dread when I go to do this, and I'm not feeling dread when I go to do that, the word that comes up for me is the commitment. You must have committed to yoga. Mm-hmm. And so what occurred for you? You could have easily been a, you know, shining star at some yoga studio, really bringing the values of the traditional Ashtanga practice to an already burgeoning yoga studio. What occurred for you that enabled you to create the shala? And in my home, I know we're calling it here Yoga Shala West, but in my home, it's like, where are you going? I'm going to the shala. Are you going to the shala today? Have you been to the shala? Like, you know, it's just, it's part of our life. I'm in my office, and I texted my daughter who's sleeping in her bedroom. I have an office at home, like, don't come in, you know, I'm on air, you know, and she knows I'm doing this call, and she texted me back, you know, you are amazing, and I am thinking about you and holding a good space for you as you interview, you know, Pranadeep. So, you know, it's like you're part of our home. You're part of our life, the shala. And it is the energy of the shala. And I wish I had the way of describing to everyone what it's like to be there. But you go in, and the first thing you do is you smell a smell. And the smell... It's not the same smell I have at my home, but it smells like home. It smells like my home away from home. It smells like home where I don't have to be anything for anybody. You know, I don't have to be anything for anybody. Cook, cleaner, wife, mother, practitioner, you know, I get to be me. And when I take my shoes off, which is what you do when you come into the shala, it's like it is... And I know this sounds almost selfish, but it is the ultimate me time. It's the ultimate time for me to say, you know, hi, Angie, you know, how are you?
Yeah.
And you know, from the flowers that fellow students will leave, when you come to the shala and you sign in, there's often food right there. And it's like, you know, if I'm feeling achy about my practice, I know I'm going to get to eat some of that after. So, you know, it's just so utterly warm. And just the kindness that is experienced in the studio itself between practitioners. And even like when someone new comes in, if the space is filled, you know, we move over our mats to let that person in. There's something about when you feel someone's creating space for you because you're coming in and you need the space, it's heartfelt, and then you're so eager to create space for someone else. I want to know what occurred within you that enabled you to make that leap. Where did you see this vision of this possibility? What took you on the journey of, you know, fitting into some other yoga studio as a master teacher, to creating this, and again, I want to use the word jewel, this beacon of light in creating your own space.
Wow. It just feels so good. It's just so heartwarming to hear the shala described in such ways. It's like, you know, yes, I buried a dream, and then I had this new dream, and now it feels like when I hear you speak, it's like, wow, this dream has been realized. You know, it just my heart is so warm. And I think what inspired me to create the space is that I did spend many years teaching in LA in a lot of different contexts. So I met you, Angela, at the Y. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I remembered earlier on from our conversation is when you were talking about how you came in that first day and you had, you know, such a moving experience on that first day. I want to paint a little bit of a picture for the others on the call, is that class was held in this gigantic gym where the doors wouldn't close all the way, that we could never get the temperature right. Like, it, what, the kitchen was right next to it. You know, it's not an ideal setting for yoga at all. And yet, we were able to create this experience together, students and teachers and all practitioners, this experience of embodied presence together. And that is what touches us. You know, it doesn't matter if the conditions are ideal. We can still drop into that experience, that felt sense in the body. And so anyway, I just thought that was, you know, so amazing that you were able to feel that, even though the conditions weren't ideal. And then, you know, moving forward, so I continued to teach at the Y. I also assisted many teachers in LA in all different, all types of rooms, Ashtanga rooms. And then I also was teaching very regularly at an Ashtanga studio in Culver City, which is a part of LA. And I was doing well, but, you know, what was happening is that I was spending a lot of time in my car. And that's something you had mentioned, Angela, is that I was just driving to from place to place. And that's like a way of life in L.A., unfortunately. It can be for many people. But it's very draining to spend that much time in the car. But that, and that, that's just one tiny aspect of it. I think the bigger thing that I was starting to sense is that even in a lot of these other rooms that I was teaching, some of this image-based achievement-oriented ethos was seeping into the yoga room. And I felt like it was my responsibility to create a space that was more nurturing, more therapeutic, and frankly, that honored my teacher. I didn't feel like my teacher's voice really existed in this city, and so I wanted to create a space where my teacher's voice and his methodology was present, and also that I had a voice. This is also something that I learned from my husband, or that I felt so supported in by my husband, is that because he's an entrepreneur, he knows the freedom that comes with that. The responsibilities, yes, but also the freedom when we are allowed to make our own choices, to lead without the pressure of fulfilling someone else's expectations. That just started to feel more and more attractive to me, you know, to not have to answer to anybody else, particularly in the yoga, in the Ashtanga yoga tradition, where respect for one's teacher is very important. And so when I was teaching in these other studios, you know, the senior teacher at the studio, that's whose voice was the voice in that studio. You know, my voice was just a complement to that. And as I grew in my practice and my teaching, I started to feel like, well, I have a voice, and I think other people need to hear it,
yeah.
You know, frankly. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what really inspired me to create the space.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm just so happy that it's flourishing.
Yeah. I so appreciate the boldness of, I have a voice and other people need to hear it. I don't think we would be given a voice or be have aware of it if it weren't of value to others. And that's an important sort of shift in consciousness to make, to own that and to step out on that and see what happens.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears a little bit now and also invite Admit in to ask any questions. And I so appreciate all that you've shared thus far, and I feel a deep sense of the spirit and the splendor of this trajectory, and I feel there's so many rich nuggets in this, and we've covered in many ways the, you know, what it takes from the inside out to birth something like you have birthed. And now I want to switch gears into the nuts and bolts of like what is involved in designing for your values. You know, I'm someone who could, I'd love to sit out at a cafe and talk about this stuff forever, you know, but do it, you know. I mean, we can, you know, we can groove on these ideas quite a bit, can't we? But to put them into form, you know, to actually you know, find a place you can afford on the West Side to have mm-hmm. a studio? And then how do you communicate this to a stranger that walks in the door and thinks, hey, you know, I'm chewing gum and, you know, do you have a yoga class starting in 5 minutes? Like, how do you establish the designing for the values and have it so solid that it's honored and respected and you're able to enroll individuals in the mm-hmm. values?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up because I also love talking about all the things we've spent an hour talking about, but I also love the nuts and bolts. Like, I really love the nuts and bolts. So I'm happy to talk about
it. It doesn't happen without it, does it? Yeah.
No. And I think, you know, when we were designing the Shala, was right around the time that I was engaging in my first laddership circle, that service, one of the offerings that the service-based community gives. And through the laddership circle, I learned the concept of creative constraints. And creative constraints are basically, the way I think of them are, what are things that I'm not going to compromise on? These are the absolutes, you know, the must-haves. And so when I was designing the Shala, I had two creative constraints. And one of them was that I did not want to turn anybody away, any dedicated practitioner away because of financial constraints. And the other creative constraint was that I needed the Shala to be self-reliant because I didn't have unlimited financial capital to be able to invest. And so with those two creative constraints in mind, then we came up with two really key design elements. And so our first one is our contribution model, in which we invite students to contribute between $100 and $200 each month with the understanding and the explicit statement that if a student cannot contribute $100 a month, then they're invited to contribute any amount underneath that $100 level. But it is expected that each student contributes every month. This isn't a quote-unquote free ride. And what that contribution model has done is that it's just allowed this practice to reach people that it wouldn't otherwise. And I don't mean just like the casual yoga student who comes and takes one class a week. These are students and practitioners who practice every day, who are either coming to the Shala or when they can't come to the Shala, practicing at home. Sorry, excuse me. Our Roomba just went on. I'm going to go ahead and turn that off. it's allowed people an access point into this practice who otherwise wouldn't have it. And it's really created a diverse community at the Shala. I'm sure you see that, Angela, is that, mm-hmm. You know, our students are coming from all races, all ethnicities, all ages. It's really amazing. We have college students, high school students at the Shala, along with, you know, people who are senior citizens, who are retired. It's really amazing. We have, you specifically asked about how we get students, you know, onboarded onto the Shala, how yes. we get them enrolled. And that is also a really unique design element in that for students who have no experience with Ashtanga, who are brand new to the practice, we ask for a 2-week commitment up front in which we ask them to come to the Shala every day, and if every day is impossible, then at least 3 days a week. And that 2 weeks is actually offered as a gift. So we're not asking for any financial compensation for those 2 weeks. And that's just been such a beautiful process because what it does is it puts the practice first and puts relationship first. So that relationship between the student and teacher and the relationship between the student and the practice. So does the student love the practice? And what I find is that if the student can make it through those 2 weeks, then they're very likely to then join us as monthly members. And if a student drops off for whatever reason, either because they don't resonate with the practice or for whatever reason, then it's sort of like no harm, no foul. You know, I'm not interested in just taking that student's money. That's not what this is about. This is about developing that deeper relationship. So those two design elements, you know, address that first creative constraint of we don't want to turn anybody away. And then in terms of being self-reliant, we've done a lot of things to help ourselves be self-reliant. You mentioned our space, and it's a really small space, but one of the things that's one of the huge blessings is that it's for LA, it's relatively affordable. And so our rent is, you know, it's feasible for us to have this model and yet still be self-reliant. And there are all kinds of other nuts and bolts that I can go into, but I feel like I've been talking for a long time, so I want to give you an opportunity to, you know, if there's anything you want to dive deeper into or anything, I want to give space for that.
You know, Angela, I want you to continue, but I did want to also open up the Q&A for any of the folks that are on the call that would like to either share a comment about what they've heard or share any insights and about Pranidhi, especially, you know, maybe if you happen to be a parent or have a question for her. And, you know, I also just want to welcome any just shared thoughts on our theme of how you stay strong in your values. And so if you're on the call, you can push *6 and you'll be entered into the queue and then you'll be prompted. And then when it's your turn, or you can always email us at ask@servicespace.org. It's ask@servicespace.org. And sorry, Angela, why don't you jump back in? I know you had a follow-up there.
Yeah, and again, I also meant to pause to, you know, any questions you want to ask. But, you know, what I think is so interesting in this is that it sounds like the contribution model that you created, that, you know, it's $100 to $200 a month, and if someone wants to go up or down from that, you know, you work it out with them so that you don't turn anyone away. And then you give the gift of 2 weeks of practice, which is a substantial gift, especially the way Ashtanga is taught, because when you're new, you actually need more attention than when you've been practicing a while, in a certain sense.
Yes, absolutely.
I think. And it sounds like those design elements in a certain way allow for who really participates, that it's almost like a self-selecting process. Like, if you can't be in the constraint of that, it's probably not for you.
Absolutely. And that's the experience that we've had. And it's interesting, you know, it's been a good practice for me to lean into the strength of that, of those constraints, because we do, like you said, we do have people walking in sometimes and just asking, like, oh, when's your next class? You know, can I drop in? And to say no, that takes some strength.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
we,
also,
sorry, yeah, I just wanna, we have a question from someone that's listening in. This is from Ilyas, who's listening in from Asheville, North Carolina. And the question he has for you is, how do you address the trend to scientize or perhaps desacralize or despiritualize yoga for Western consumption, which is perhaps especially true in L.A.?
It's a great question. So for me, yoga, it's an interesting question, because the spiritual aspects of yoga, to me, come through the felt experience of the body, which I've talked about a couple times on the call already. It's that ability that the practice gives us to drop into the present moment. And particularly if we're in community, when that's happening, it's all the more powerful. That, to me, is different than the religious connotations that yoga tends to have in India and actually even here in LA or in the Western world in general. Yoga seems to be inextricably linked to a sort of pseudo-Hindu religiosity. And I actually find that when that stuff isn't linked to authenticity, when it isn't grounded, it actually ends up turning people away from the practice. And yet I really hear the question in terms of how do we honor those roots and how do we honor that felt experience without giving over to this image-based culture. And one thing I've done to kind of increase the level of authenticity or to bring more authenticity to the yoga world in at large is are the practice videos that you mentioned, Angela. In those mm-hmm. videos, I consciously try to invite practitioners to be a part of those videos who have all kinds of different bodies, different abilities. And we do chant in those videos. We chant at the beginning. We chant at the end. So there is a connection to source and a connection to lineage. And then in between that chanting, it's just the practice. And it's about creating that felt experience. And so for me, I guess it just comes down to authenticity. Yeah.
Beautiful. You know, in thinking about this path that you've taken, and you know, I loved how at the call that, you know, Angela sort of set up the foundation really well with, you know, starting with your cultural and environmental upbringing. But, you know, one aspect of that I wanted to just sort of hear about was, how did your parents play a role in this? You know, I know that especially for, you know, being, you know, Indian American myself, you know, traditionally the roles or expectations of children, especially growing up now over here with the opportunities, it's take a traditional path, you know, whether it's medicine or law or business or, you know, technology, whatever have you. And so to take this sort of non-traditional path, whether it was first acting at first and then now in teaching yoga, I'm just curious, you know, how your parents felt about that and then how you guys worked through that over the years.
Yeah, well, it's such a great question. I joke that my parents got the two most rebellious daughters that they could have because both my sister and I have really tested them. it certainly wasn't easy. I think, you know, at the root of some of these pressures that we feel as a first or second generation immigrants in this country, at the root of them is really this felt sense of scarcity. You know, our parents came here with very little, and what they want for their kids is the opposite of that. They want abundance for their kids. And so the traditional path to abundance is these careers, like that you mentioned, these very stable careers that are going to give us financial abundance. And so when it became clear that I wasn't going down that route, I think it was difficult for my parents. And it did strain our relationship at times, but what's been amazing for me to witness is that unconditional love that parents have. Because though they didn't understand some of the choices that I was making, they chose to support me regardless. And that's been a really beautiful journey to be on with them. And it was funny, like, you know, when I sort of started transitioning away from acting and toward yoga, I had the sense that they were breathing a sigh of relief, actually, because at least yoga was something that they felt, I don't know, and this is just perception on my part, but I felt like yoga was something that was a part of our culture, our background, even though we didn't practice it actively as a family. It was still a connection to our roots in some way. And so it was more familiar to them than this other world that I had been playing in for many years. And then I also think getting married helped. <You know? laughs> If I'm being fully honest. You know, because then there is that sense that, okay, there's a grounding here. You know, there's a support network that I had. That I think as a parent, it's you want your kids to be secure, and so that added level of security and support really helped them to be able to relax and just support me fully.
That's wonderful, mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that as they're listening to this call, they're seeing the beautiful impact that you're having on so many people, and it's just so thoughtful, you know, listening to the design principles that went into how you've set everything up and this idea of really creating connection. It's beautiful. I'm going to go to one of our callers, and again, if you have a question, you can push *6 on your phone, and you'll be entered into the queue, and just tell us your name, where you're calling in from, and then share your comment or question. So going to our first caller.
Hello, Panidhi. This is Birju calling. I'm really appreciating this call. I've really enjoyed volunteering alongside you for some time now in these laddership circles that you've alluded to. And what I'm curious to hear your reflections on is, having walked this journey of stepping into the uncomfortable for so long in multiple different ways, what would you say is your own edge of growth right now?
Wow, Birju, you just have such a knack for asking questions. You know, one thing that comes to mind, actually, is something that I've been playing with at the Shala. An edge of my growth, actually, an edge of the community's growth is... I've been sort of exploring ways that I can invite students to feel more and more empowered in their contributions to the Shala, not financial contributions, but other types of contributions, and actually challenge them to contribute more so that the Shala becomes more self-sufficient. I think what's happened up to this point is that I've basically been in charge, and that's very comfortable for me, because I like being in charge. And what I'm more interested in now is seeing if I can let go of that a little bit and allow the Shala to become a little more self-organizing and a little more self-sufficient, frankly, because one of our creative constraints was to be self-reliant. And when I first envisioned that creative constraint, it was very much tied to finances. But as I'm growing the Shala, I'm realizing that self-reliance is not just about finances. It's like, I want to get the Shala to a place where when I leave town, it's cool, you know? And so I'm just exploring different ways to do that now. So that's an edge that I'm actively exploring and looking forward to exploring more.
It's wonderful. And thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hi, Pranidhi. This is Jacob Kramer.
Hi, Jacob.
Hi. So I think your contribution model is, like, really cool. Like, it's been awesome, like, hearing more about Vishala today. And I was wondering how you balance both financial and otherwise, like, how do you balance the need for, obviously, like a stable income for Vishala with the desire to, like, allow people to, like, openly come to your yoga studio and practice Ashtanga?
Thank you for that question. So going into building the Shala or creating the space, I knew that I didn't want to turn anybody away. And I also am very fortunate in that my income from yoga teaching at this point in my life doesn't need to support me fully. I have other streams of income that support me, and mainly that's my husband. So I'm very grateful for that financial support because it did allow me to step into this somewhat risky model. That being said, I did want to make sure that the Shala was at least self-reliant because we don't have unlimited reserves to pour into the space. And it's been an interesting line for me to walk, because one thing that I've started noticing a little bit is that I do hold a small amount of judgment on some of the contributions that come in. For example, if contributions come in that are a little bit lower, on the lower end, like below $100 or significantly below $100, I do find myself carrying a little bit of judgment about that. And so it's been a really interesting practice for me to just sort of look into that judgment, see where it's coming from, and challenge myself to receive whatever contribution is being offered as a gift to the Shala. So that's been an interesting line for me to walk. And it's been an interesting way for me to really step into the trust. So our motto as a Shala in terms of our model is that we're moving from transaction to trust, because what I felt like was happening in the yoga culture was it was becoming very transactional. You know, you pay for a class, and then you get this experience, and then you walk into the studio and the first thing you see is a huge boutique and you buy that expensive piece of clothing and then, you know, you're going to become enlightened. Yeah. So that's what I was experiencing, is this very transactional quality. And I wanted to move away from that to a more trusting quality. And so it's been interesting because it's been a challenge to receive every contribution as a gift, regardless of the amount, whether it's $25 a month or $250 a month. And we do have that wide of a range of students contributing. It's been a really good practice for me to view each student as equal and view each contribution as a gift. And then to see how trust emerges from that, because then what happens is that it's no longer, okay, this student is giving me this, and this student is giving me that, and this student is giving me that. It's, oh, wow, the community is contributing this much. And it just allows me to lean into trust even more.
And I want to jump in here. This is Angela. And it feels to me like what you have to hold so solidly is how deeply you value whole yoga and value the Ashtanga practice, value the Shala, and that's another kind of way you're enrolling the students. Like if they practice there, they are to value it the way you mm-hmm. value it, because it's easy to say, oh, well, because I've tried to explain the fee structure to other people, and they're like, oh, it's pay as you can. Oh, it's this. And it's like, in my own practice as a spiritual practitioner, when I would work on a sliding scale, I had an example of somebody coming to me to my office and saying, I can't pay today. And I said, okay. And I happened to run into them at a store when they were buying a rug later right. that day. Yeah. Or, yeah. you know, and I had a few of those things, and I felt really hurt.
Yeah, and I've experienced
what's
that
going
as well.
On? And you know, people will spend $250 a month getting their hair done, but what are they contributing to the Shala? I mean, how do you mm-hmm. how yeah. do you address that in your design?
That's such an insightful point, because I actually recently had this experience where I have a student that's contributing, you know, what I perceive to be a pretty low amount. And then I saw the student eating lunch at a restaurant, and so I had so much judgment almost immediately that came up, and I had to take a step back and sort of think about where that judgment was coming from, and then I tried to put myself in the student's shoes, and I thought, maybe this is the only meal that she's eating all day, you know? How do I know? And just that simple shift in perspective allowed me to then again love the student, because mm-hmm. it's really, I think in this model, it's really not up to me to dictate what anybody is contributing. It's really up to that student to feel into what they can sustainably contribute. And that was, so I'm actually really grateful that that experience happened, because it was a test of my values, and it challenged me, and so I'm grateful mm-hmm. for that challenge. And one other thing that I want to address, and Jacob, in your question, and something you brought up, Angela, as well, is the sense of responsibility that I try to instill in the community. So, yes, it's contribute what you can with the expectation that a contribution is coming every month. So I have had students who have tried to shirk off that responsibility And in those instances, I do make it very clear that the responsibility is a part of our ethos, and this isn't a space where it's okay to just not contribute anything, because that contribution is important to the work we're doing, even if that contribution is $1. And what I've found is that when students can't get on board with that, then they just leave, and that's okay with me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's really cool and very inspiring.
That's great.
Thanks for asking, Jacob.
Just so that our callers are aware, Jacob is, you know, he was one of our interns last summer. We had Service Space as a 9-week or 10-week internship every summer, and Jacob is just in high school, and Bernithi was one of his mentors. So in addition to all the wonderful work that Bernithi does at the Shala and, you know, in her writing and her videos, she also took time out of her schedule to mentor Jacob and participate in our internship. And, you know, while I have you on the phone there, Jacob, if there's any thoughts that you wanted to share of what it was like to have Pranidhi as your mentor, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, you know, I really, like, gained a lot out of that last summer. And I think it's been almost a year since then. I don't know. I feel like this year, I was a junior this year, so it was a very stressful time of my life. But from our leadership circle, I kind of learned to just, like, I don't know. I guess, like, be more mindful of myself and how, like, the stress I'm feeling, and just sort of recognize it. So whenever something would put me down, I'd kind of just take a little bit to think about it and just be more conscientious, I suppose. And that was, like, one of our lessons for one of the weeks of the leadership circle. And I've also been actually, we had to meditate quite a lot during the leadership circle. And although I don't do it for, like, an hour every day like we did during the circle, I actually downloaded, like, this meditation app onto my Amazon Echo. And every night before I go to bed, I've been really good about this for the past couple months. I've been, like, meditating, just, like, laying down. And it's really... It's made junior year so much easier for me, and now that I'm finishing it up, it's like, I don't know, I guess just having Pranidhi as my mentor, and, you know, every time we would, like, do a Skype call, she would do, like, a little, like, thing at the end of it where she'd, like, read, like, four lines, and it was very, like, calm and soothing, and I've kind of, like, taken all of her advice to heart, so thank you so much.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear, Jacob.
Thank you for sharing that. Really appreciate that. And Pranidhi, thank you for being such a wonderful mentor. And you know, just hearing and sharing all the wonderful things that you have during the call. I know that we're coming close to the end of our call, and you know, I wanted to see if Angela had any questions. I have one or two left on my side, and then we'll move towards closing.
Well, I would love to hear your questions, and I just want to say, one comment as I listen to the caller's questions and listen to you is that it just, what's impacting me is how much this kind of values-based business requires you to stay awake, because it's always in progress. It's not like set and now it's running. It's in progress, and you're responding to... you know, you're responding to various needs as you move forward. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful observation. And I just, actually, that's all, sort of what my next question is sort of based upon that, and what you and Angela were speaking about earlier about, you know, you were describing this experience when your manager had called you and you started sensing this feeling of dread or hesitation, or really I have to go to an audition. And so often, you know, I feel like many of us, or I'll even just speak for myself, you know, my body is telling me something, you know, it's in one form or another, yet we ignore that and we push through that just because, oh, well, we think it's going to affect our livelihood or how someone might perceive us, or you know, even in the case of judgment too, you know, you feel this, I know I should be doing one thing, but I'm feeling this. And so And it is such an active process. And I'm curious, how do you keep yourself both aware of what's actually happening inside and being consistent to that, as well as, helping yourself determine what is the right path, what is the best way for you to grow and look at some of these situations and dissect it?
For me, I think commitment to practice is just the most essential. That's also part of the ethos of the Shala, is that I really try to encourage the students to practice every day, because I think that without that consistent dedication to practice, without that mechanism that you have to check in every day, you know, to look in a mirror, but really the mirror is turned inward, without that check-in process on a consistent basis, I don't know how you are able to tap into what's authentically going on inside one's body. And the way, I think the most effective way that I inspire my students to commit to daily practice is to commit to daily practice myself. I'm there pretty much every day at the Shala, opening the doors and doing my practice. And as I'm practicing, other students start to walk in. And so that's just how my morning begins every day, is opening the doors to the Shala, laying down my mat, practicing, and then being there in community with students as they also begin their practice, and then very naturally, finishing my practice and then stepping into that teacher role for the next 3 hours. It's just such a beautiful way to begin the day. And all that to say that I just think commitment is the key. And then from there, like how we take those lessons off the mat, that requires skill. And that's where I come back to what Angela was talking about at the beginning of the call, is that this is a process. And you just mentioned this as well, Angela. This is a process. We're going to make mistakes. So we're going to have stumbles. We're going to have moments where we're not living into our authenticity, or we're not skillful, or we have an outburst, or something, you know. There could be any number of ways that these things manifest. But with commitment to practice, we become more and more skillful, I believe. Yeah.
It's beautiful. We have one more caller, so I do want to take this last caller, and then we'll have one more question on my side.
Hi, Pranidhi. This is Papa and Mama.
Hi.
We have been listening to this conversation, beautiful conversation and very thought-provoking conversation, and we do appreciate and thank you. It's not a question. We just wanted to give our share our feeling and support to you. And we are so proud that you have done such an amazing, wonderful job of yourself and then giving your
back to the community.
Your knowledge back to the community, how you are helping others to live what they should be living.
In many ways, I feel that you have led us to a better path of righteousness. You know, you always were so strong and determined and committed to, you know, what you envisioned your life. And that has been an inspiration to us. And like I said, you know, it just led us to a stronger path of being honest to yourself, honest to others around you, and be righteous, you know, in any situation.
So that's it. We just wanted to get
out. I'm crying.
I know. I'm tearing up over here.
Me too. God.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Just one more thing I just wanted to say. So we as a parent, you know, sometimes we said we want to teach you, but Prendi has taught us well back, right? Yes. We appreciate Prendi. You've given us a lot of insight how to lead a righteous
better life.
Appreciate it.
Wow. Wow. I just feel so grateful to be in this space, you know. What a beautiful opportunity for me to, I feel like I play the role of teacher certain periods of time throughout the day, but really I have so many teachers around me, and just so, so grateful to have all the teachers, Mama, Papa, Birju, Jacob, Amit, Angela, you're all my teachers as well.
Thank you. Well, you know, we like to always ask, is there any way that we as a larger service-based community can continue to support the work that you're doing?
What I would love is for everyone on the call to take a little time today to consciously love themselves. That's something that's really alive for me these days, is how I can grow in my capacity to love myself. And so it would just mean the world to me if everyone took some time today to love themselves.
That's beautiful. And do you mind if we make a small request of you?
Sure.
We've heard about it from Angela, and I'm sure from others that you know, you usually like to end your yoga classes with a beautiful chant, and so perhaps maybe give our callers an opportunity to hear your voice.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to do that.
And so,
in honor of my parents, I'd like to chant the specific mantra. And then, Amit, do we close with a minute of silence afterwards?
Okay. Yes. And so maybe what you can do is you can say the mantra, and then we will just go straight into a minute of silence, but in gratitude for this call, for all of our teachers, and for everyone co-creating this space today.
Beautiful. Twamiva mata chapita twamiva. Twamiva bandhuscha sakha twamiva. Twameva vidya dravinam twameva. Twameva sarvam mama deva deva. Kayena vacha manasendriyarva. Buddhyatmanava prakritirvabhavat. Karomi adiyat sakalam paras. Mai Narayana yeti samarpayami. Narayana yeti samarpayami. Narayana yeti samarpayami.
Thank you. That was just so beautiful. Better way to end this call, other than I'm going to just take everyone off of mute for a second, and that way maybe we can all just do a collective thank you to Pranithi. And Pranithi, thank you. Angela, thank you for your masterful job at moderating today. And, you know, we wish you all the best of luck with the Shala, Pranithi. Sounds wonderful.
Thank you both so much. Thank you.
So on a count of three, one, two, and three, thank you, Pranithi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.